chapter 9, verses 2 to 13. Mark chapter 9, verses 2 to 13, and that's on page 713 of the church Bible. Mark chapter 9, beginning verse 2. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, they were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud. "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, "Why do teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first?" Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him."
Today on Mount Hermon. It's very likely that that is where these events that we read about today took place. Mount Hermon is if it's just one mountain, it's a mighty long one. It's really a kind of long, lumbering mountain range, about 30 miles long. It runs southwest to northeast, and in today's geography, it serves as the border between Lebanon and Syria, but also on its southern flanks it has the Golan Heights. It's home, as some of you may well be aware, it's home to a good number of United Nations observers. That's a very hazy photo. It shows some of the southern flanks, the southern slopes of Mount Hermon, and at the very bottom of that photo, it will not be possible for us to make out any detail at all, but at the very bottom are the remains of the Roman town of Caesarea Philippi, which is where Jesus and his disciples have just been. That's where they had the all-important conversation about the identity of Jesus, the conversation in which Peter declared correctly who Jesus is. That's only back in the previous chapter, Mark chapter 8, and it, in all likelihood, it looks as if it took place not very long before the events that we've just read, that Tom read to us today. Also, on that photo, but again, not particularly visible, just there, the ruins of a great fortress from Crusader times, the great fortress of Nimrod. Now, another photo which I hope is slightly clearer. The photos can be deceptive. From a distance, this looks just like something that might be in the Lake District or the Pennines here in England. However, Mount Hermon is over 9,000 feet high, which makes it more than double the height of Ben Nevis, and it's more than 3 times higher than any other mountain in the whole of Israel or the whole region to the south of this. That photo looks a little bit like a spring photo with the remains of some snow on it. In the winter, Mount Hermon is high enough to have a full covering of snow, and there's a thriving ski resort there in our own day. In the summer, it is beautifully cool, while down below Galilee, really, just down below to the South Galilee, bakes in the summer heat, but the slopes of Mount Hermon are lovely and cool. I don't think we know or have any way of guessing what time of year it was that Jesus and those three disciples went up there, nor do we have any clue about how high they might have gone. There are actually all kinds of questions we could ask about this incident. Why does it seem so brief? It seems to be over in a flash. Why Elijah and Moses? Why not David, Isaiah, Joshua? Why not a whole bunch of other characters? Why Elijah and Moses? Why does Peter make that offer to build shelters for them? Why does Jesus tell them that they must keep this to themselves, at least for a specified period of time? Why is there this kind of non-disclosure agreement attached to this event? Why do they ask afterwards very specifically about Elijah? All kinds of questions make this one of the slightly puzzling corners of the Gospel accounts, don't they? I think there is just one principal overarching question that we need to answer, and probably it would mop up a good few of the others. And it's really the question in a different form that I asked when the children were here just a few minutes ago. The question of what is all this for? What is it for? What is its purpose? What's it about? The thing is, there is actually no other moment like this in the Gospels. No other moment like this. A veil is drawn aside, and Jesus is shown shining in heavenly splendor. It's magnificent, but it's so different from everything else that we read. And also, it's only witnessed by three disciples, those three that Jesus chose specifically for this. He took them up into the mountains with him, away from the others. So what is this for? Is it, for instance, now I honestly, I could testify that I used to think this, probably for a good long while, this is roughly how I thought about it. I thought it must be that the Son of God has an appointment scheduled with Moses and Elijah. It must be that he needed to meet them. A discussion needed to take place. And he happened to take three disciples along, perhaps for company, on the path up into the mountains and back down. So they end up a little bit like, say, they're waiting at table and there's a big meeting that turns out to be a top secret strategy meeting taking place among people who are dining, and they're just the waiters or the attendants who are privileged to overhear snatches of it. I used to think it was something like that. What is going on here, and what role does it play in the Gospel account? The answer is actually reasonably clear when we look closely. This is for the disciples. This is absolutely and entirely for them. It's directed at them. Something is being shown to them. It's plain in the language. Three very clear hints, pointers. In verse 2, he was transfigured before them. Verse 4, there appeared before them Elijah and Moses. And in verse 7, that voice from the cloud, we interpret that absolutely rightly as God's own voice. A voice from heaven spoke, God the Father, and the voice spoke to them. This is my Son whom I love, listen to him. I don't think it makes sense to think that the voice was speaking to Moses and Elijah. Listen to him. Give him the honor that is due to him. This is my Son. So, in three ways we can see it is for them. This breathtaking display is for their benefit. Just those three disciples. It's to strengthen them. It's to encourage them. It's to reassure them. It's to confirm in them the things that they are steadily coming to believe. It's to lift their view of Jesus up higher, much higher than it has been. Effectively, I would suggest to say something like this. Yes, it's true that Jesus, the man from Nazareth, is 100% real, 100% human being. But it's also true that Jesus, the man from heaven, is the Son of God, and that is also 100% real. And in effect, it's perhaps saying, here is just a little spoiler of what that really looks like. What it really looks like. And what we should notice is that once again, this follows hot on the heels of that confession of Christ. It's 2 weeks ago that we read it. This is back in chapter 8, verse 29. Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Do you remember that verse? Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." And it's the first moment of actually putting into words the truth that was forming in their understanding of who Jesus is. And we saw last week that Jesus immediately wanted to teach them the implications of that. What does it mean? If I'm the Messiah, well, what does it mean? And first of all, it was a very tough warning. There is suffering ahead, wasn't it? Well, that's where we were last week. And it's interesting, actually, that they are given a week to digest that. This is quite unusual in Mark's Gospel. He tells us, specifically, 6 days passed between the last verse and this new passage. 6 days passed. So they've had a week to digest the very, very difficult information that there is real, serious suffering ahead. I think they are now shown this by way of balance. This is to balance what they've been trying to digest, trying to cope with over these last 6 days. Jesus is the Messiah, yes, and that means splendor as well as suffering. It means exaltation as well as humiliation. Now, it's true that the path ahead leads through the valley of the shadow of death. That's true. But the path doesn't end in that valley. The path then climbs up the other side. It climbs up out of the valley into the amazing and beautiful and bright sunshine beyond. I don't know if any of you will remember. Well, it's thinking back a long way, but if you know famous speeches of Winston Churchill, not perhaps the original time he said it, Winston Churchill used a very interesting phrase, the broad sunlit uplands. You might remember that from one of his famous speeches. The broad sunlit uplands as a promise of what can be ahead if we survive this trial that we are in. That was in one of his very famous speeches. Up ahead, in other words, here, it's a very spiritual phrase that he used in a political setting, but here it's where it would really belong. Ahead, there is the sheer beauty of heaven. There is dazzling splendor. There is relief from all pain and suffering. It's true that it lies on the other side of the valley of death, but it is there. And the disciples are shown a glimpse, a hint of it, in what we see this time. I believe that again and again, this is to be impressed on the disciples of Jesus, then and now. Peter and James and John have it confirmed to them in three ways. They see the dazzling light that shines from Jesus himself. So visibly, they see it visibly, and they hear it in words. They hear the voice of God expressing his approval of his Son. And then they see it by association, if I can put it like that. The association of Jesus, the man they knew from Nazareth, the association of him with two awesomely impressive figures from history, Moses and Elijah. There is Jesus, their friend, the rabbi from Nazareth, rubbing shoulders with Moses and with Elijah. Just imagine for a moment. Imagine there's a general election coming up. And I'm standing as a candidate here in the local constituency. I am, me. And let's say I'm an independent candidate, so that I'm not nailing any colours to any masks. And I try to appeal for your votes. Would any of you vote for me? Don't answer that, please. Not many. I would lose my deposit, don't you think? Yeah, I would lose my deposit. But what if I could place in your minds right now, this week, only a few days before the election, the notion that a heroic figure from our past, Winston Churchill, would approve of me. If I can place into your minds the image, I'm not talking about deep fake technology or anything like that, just the idea that Winston Churchill stands right here and his arm is around my shoulders and he says to you, this man is the one you want, vote for him. Imagine that. Would I get a few more votes? I'm hoping you'll say yes, because the point is the association with an absolute hero from the past. I'm trivializing it a little bit by suggesting those rather fanciful things. But you see, at the very least, something like that, and much, much more, is happening in this passage. We should linger for a moment, actually, on Elijah and Moses. And I asked the question earlier, and we haven't answered it yet. Why them? Why those two? Exactly. Moses first. Moses himself said to the Israelite nation in his final address, which is the book of Deuteronomy, or chunk of it. He said this, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own brothers. You must listen to him." Same words, those last words are the same words they heard from the voice of God. Moses is intimately associated with the promises of the end, when a prophet like Moses will come, like Moses and more, to be sure. But you see, they knew that. Jewish people, the Israelite people knew that. And Elijah, probably even more with Elijah, because he himself, in some form, was expected to return. Malachi chapter 4 verse 5, so this is almost the closing words of the Old Testament. "See, I will send you the prophet Elijah before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes." So Israel was expecting Elijah, or someone in the role of Elijah, someone you could say perhaps with the mantle of Elijah, or with the power, or with the personality of Elijah, to come and restore the nation to righteousness in preparation for the end of time. And now, right here before these three disciples, both of these men appear. And in the middle of them, I reckon, is Jesus. The meaning could hardly be clearer. Now is the time, this is the moment, for God's promises to be fulfilled. I want to emphasize something really very important about this event that I firmly believe, but again, we have to work hard to get our minds around this. Peter, James, and John are shown something very real. This is not a hallucination. We can say that straight away because all three of them witnessed the same thing. If they hadn't, it could not have been recorded like this. It's not a hallucination. It's not a dream. It's not a vision. One reason I say that is that Peter's reaction is entirely grounded in the realm of concrete, tangible reality. He sees in front of him three men who they could almost reach out and touch. Three men who are flesh and blood. Because Peter makes this offer, this suggestion of building shelters for them. We need to come back to those shelters in a moment. But you see, there are three men standing on the mountainside before them. It's not a kind of shimmering vision up on the horizon. Three men right in front of them. Moses, flesh and blood. Elijah, flesh and blood. And Jesus, because it's the Jesus that they just walked up the mountain with. So he's not suddenly made into a vision or some kind of some spectral thing. He's there, the same Jesus. So it's very, very real. I want to try to impress that on you. It's very real. But it's also obvious that they cannot begin to understand it. They don't even start to understand it. They don't get it. And we realize that Jesus himself doesn't expect them to, because he gives them strict orders not to talk about it until significantly later. Not until after I've risen from the dead. Keep it to yourselves until then. That is really very, very interesting. So they are not to go saying to the others, hey, you guys and you boys will never forget what, you will never believe what we've just seen. There's not to be that kind of talk. They are to keep it to themselves. That probably, I think, explains why there are only three present and not all 12 disciples, because whatever it is they've seen is not to spread. It's to be kept secure until later. And one day they will remember this and it will make sense. But in the meantime, it's not going to. So just quickly, in what ways are they failing to understand? There's probably a couple we should identify. One, Peter's reaction. Let's build shelters, he says. We often puzzle over that. Let's build shelters. It might not be as odd as it sounds. Many Jews believed, and many still do, for good reason, that the final day, the great final celebration, later in the New Testament, there is reference to the wedding supper of the Lamb, but there is Old Testament suggestion that the final celebration will take the form of something like the ancient Feast of Tabernacles, the third, the final, the greatest, the most joyful of all of the Israelite feasts. There is a strong indication at the end of the prophecy of Zechariah that we can link tabernacles with the end. So that is just a very hazy picture of a modern day family gathering celebrating tabernacles with a shelter, a temporary tent, branches and leaves, eating a meal out in the garden or out in the yard, somewhere like that. That's the form that tabernacles typically will take. The idea of tabernacles then and still today would be that everybody must go quickly, probably in a hurry, go out, cut branches, build shelters with those branches, and you spend the night out in those shelters. The shelters are sometimes called booths and sometimes called tabernacles. So maybe Peter, seeing Jesus glorified and Moses and Elijah present, thought immediately, this is the end. And he wanted to react straight away in a way that's in tune with Old Testament thinking and prepare for the feast, the celebration. Makes sense up to a point, but he was forgetting everything he had just been told about the need for suffering before the end. He thought they were jumping straight to the end, and he hadn't taken on board anything of what Jesus has been trying to teach them about the suffering that lies ahead. Second, misunderstanding. Just very briefly, the question that they ask on the way down the mountain, what about Elijah? They want to know what about Elijah, because you see, they've just seen Elijah momentarily, but then he disappeared again. And Elijah, in their thinking, is supposed to come and prepare the nation for repentance and for righteousness and to be ready for the end. And Elijah is a figure who in the Old Testament is prominent and powerful, and they would expect the same. So they're puzzled. They're really puzzled. So this is just in order to explain what's going on in that question. Jesus then very simply and very briefly says to them, Elijah's been and gone. He has come, and he's been killed. John the Baptist is the Elijah figure. And that's really Jesus giving us a very clear indication that we should link John the Baptist with the expected Elijah. But those are just mopping up one or two of the points. I want to bring the whole discussion forward now to our own day. If this was for the disciples then it is very, very definitely for us now. Just like Peter and his friends, and just like the church in Rome, for which Mark, they're the people that Mark was writing for a generation later, just like them back then, we also need to be reassured and encouraged and strengthened. We also, like them, face all kinds of trouble. We do not have any guarantee that we will not be targeted for our faith. as people are in many, many parts of the world. This world is still hostile to Jesus Christ and his followers. And just like everything else in the Gospels, this episode comes to us as an eyewitness account. Here are the words of Peter in his second letter, and he refers in that letter directly to what he saw on the mountain that day. 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 16. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty, for he received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory, saying, "This is my Son, whom I love, with him I am well pleased." We ourselves heard this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain. I repeat what I said a moment ago. Again and again, this is to be impressed on the disciples of Jesus, then and now. We should not relegate this to a kind of strange, unusual corner of the gospel account that we can't really quite fathom or understand what was going on, or we don't really know why it's there. We should not do that. We should not sideline this and place it in a rather odd category. This is very, very central indeed. It should be impressed upon us. Something else. The power of this event, the value of it, doesn't lie in being an eyewitness of it. Because the three men who were eyewitnesses of it couldn't make head or tail of it. So the power and the value of it lie in the retelling. Telling it over and over again, one generation to the next. Later, only later, they could tell the others, and they could all tell the church, and it would make sense. People would be able to understand it in the end. And so, I would say we are to picture this. We are to picture it in our mind's eye as best we can, and we are to read it and believe it and cling firmly to the truth that in something like this, it is possible to see, to get a glimpse, to see with the eyes of faith Jesus in the truth of who he is, with a dignity and a splendor and a majesty that are simply, literally of course, out of this world. And we're to be strengthened by that. We are to be strengthened in our trials by that knowledge. And as I said to the children earlier, when we see him, on the day when we see him revealed in his glory, I believe it will be at least as magnificent as what they saw that day. Maybe more so. Maybe far, far more so. I mentioned earlier the need for balance. Balance between the suffering and the splendor. Balance between the humiliation and the exaltation. For Peter and his friends in those days, one very real error, one persistent error that they were perhaps bound to make is that they would get overexcited about the glory that lay ahead, and they would manage to forget or turn a deaf ear to the warnings of pain and humiliation and persecution that would come first. So balance is needed. And it's actually a balance that we need to pay attention to as well. We can slip unawares. We today, Christian believers and churches around the world, can slip unawares into just overemphasizing one at the expense of the other, downplaying the other. If anything, now this is a massive broad brush comment, but it rings true in when you read any of the history. If anything, the Western Church down the centuries, and by that I mean the medieval church and the Roman Catholic tradition and the Protestant tradition, and therefore our churches in this part of the world as a very general pattern, if anything, these churches have been concerned to teach well the agony of the cross and the seriousness of sin. Rightly, quite rightly, I would not want to downplay that. But therefore, these churches have become just slightly wary of celebrating the exalted and the glorified and the risen Lord. Instinctively just a little bit nervous of of joy and jubilation. We do well, I think, we do well to remember, for instance, when we break bread. That's a time to be serious, of course it is, and something to take seriously, and it's a time for sober reflection. But it's not miserable. It's not to be miserable. Remember the New Testament pattern. After suffering, victory. Keep the balance. Meanwhile, just to put the other side of the same coin, meanwhile, in many churches and churches of any variety, you will meet this. There can be the opposite temptation, the temptation to slip into what ends up becoming an over-exuberance, and it can be very shallow. Singing and dancing, perhaps, as though the end has already come, and never really addressing the more uncomfortable questions, which are there and must be addressed, questions of repentance, questions of carrying a cross, questions of why Calvary was even needed. One very last thing, and closer to us personally, that we must also take from these verses. Here we see the Lord giving us a glimpse of himself. A glimpse of himself. And he gives those glimpses to encourage, to assure, to confirm his word. Just as I said, for those disciples back then. And many people would testify that he still does so. In some way, glimpses. Times when the veil is pulled aside just ever so slightly. It might be very simple. It might be when we are given clear words of guidance, clear words of teaching, which answer unspoken questions. Questions that we hadn't shared with anybody, and yet we hear something that answers them. Or the evidence that we receive that lies in answered prayer. Or it could be those times in worship and in prayer when the Holy Spirit himself overwhelms us, fills our senses and speaks to us in ways that are personal to us, ways that could not be conjured up by music or by atmosphere. There is, though, one vital point we need to remember here. These things are momentary. They appear and then they are gone. Just like that day up on the mountain, we mustn't expect them to last. Verse 8 in our passage said this: suddenly when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. And for us also, in the end, there's just Jesus. We might be given glimpses that are beautiful, that inspire us and that encourage us. But the glimpse will be over and then it's just Jesus. And we may then be, again, struggling along in the valley. We may find that everything else is stripped away. But we need to be on the path with him. And he will then be on the path with us. Just as those disciples had to simply walk back down that mountain path. Let's pray.